is the meeting of House Fisheries, and it will come to order at 10:03 a.m. in room 120. Welcome, everyone. Turn your phones off, please, or at least turn them on mute. And today is Thursday, April 6th, 2017. Members present are Representative Tarr, Representative Fansler, Representative Chenault, and Representative Newman, and myself, Chair Stutes. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business today. We're also joined by Kelly Burnett from the House Records, Somers Cole from the LIO, and Reed was here. Reed Harris, my. You'll see him when he comes in. Today we are considering House Joint Resolution 9, Canadian Mines on Transboundary Rivers. We have a CS before us, version D. May I get a motion to adopt this as the working document?
Madam Chair, I move that the committee adopt the CS HJR 930-LS0303-D as the working document.
Thank you, Representative Fansler, and I will object for purposes of discussion. Therefore, would the sponsor please come forward, place himself on the record, and address the changes in the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for agreeing to hear House Joint Resolution 9 today. Madam Chair, this particular resolution mirrors closely the resolution brought before this committee in the fall of this past year, and it continues to be a needed resolution for calling for the continued protection of our very, very valuable salmon industry, seafood industry that exists in our state of Alaska. But remind the committee members that it was Senator Sullivan who addressed our body about a month and a half ago, talking about the importance of the seafood industry to the economy of Alaska, and how Alaska provides 60% of the seafood products that are sold within the United States today. And if we continue to look for ways to enhance and protect that valuable part of our economy, those numbers only stand to grow in the future. Madam Chair, House Joint Resolution 9 declares the Alaska State Legislature's support for measures the U.S. Congress and the U.S. State Department can take to ensure that Alaskans have their voice heard in relationship to transboundary mining issues. As British Columbia continues to expand their mining industry, Alaskans deserve to know how mining development affects our transboundary rivers, and if necessary, to have mechanisms and precautions to protect our watersheds. HGR 9 urges the federal government to continue working with the Canadian government to investigate downstream effects of industrial development and to develop measures to ensure the safety of our state resources. We have heard on this issue from all sides. Thousands of Alaskans have expressed their concern for our watersheds. Our governor and lieutenant governor have been vocal on the issue, and now Senators Murkowski and Sullivan are pushing for reform at the federal level. It is time for the Alaska legislature to join their ranks in this particular effort. And with that, Madam Chair, this is in no way an anti-mining resolution. It's a resolution in support of our very, very valuable seafood industry, and it's a small step in looking to protect and enhance that valuable industry. And with that, Madam Chair, I will have my staffer, Ms. Hamp, who will go through some explanation of the changes in the CS.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee, for the record, I'm Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Ortiz. Thanks for having us today. I will go over changes from version A to version D, which is the committee substitute. On page 1, line 14, we inserted "and operating" to clarify that it includes both operating and proposed mines. On page 2, line 1, we have a list of mines, and we wanted to make sure the list was accurate and up to date, so we inserted the Bruce Jack mine. Page 2, line 2, we deleted "headwaters of the" and inserted "watershed" as a clarification of the terminology. On page 2, line 11, we inserted the 2016 BC Auditor General's report as an additional resource. Page 2, line 16, we inserted a whereas clause regarding the Statement of Cooperation on Protection of Transboundary Waters signed by the State of Alaska and the Province of British Columbia on October 6, 2016, as an additional resource and reference. And on page 2, line 20, we inserted another whereas clause for another additional resource and reference regarding Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, and I will remove my objection. And we have several invited speakers today. The list, which will include Fred Olson of the Village of Kasan, Rob Sanderson, Central Council Tlingit Haida Indian Tribes, Dr. Dave Chambers, who is a geologist and president of the Center for Science in Public Participation, Lindsay Bloom, UFA, Kristen Sheldon Walker, project manager for McDowell, Chris Zimmer, Rivers Without Borders, Heather Hardcastle, Salmon Beyond Borders. And that will sum up our invited testimony. So we will go to them now, and we will start with, in the room, we have Chris Zimmer.
Madam Chair, as a note, Mr. Rob Sanderson is not here today.
Thank you. Oh, I am. Please, if you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Chris Zimmer. I'm the Alaska Campaign Director for Rivers Without Borders. I've been working in Juneau on transboundary rivers issues for 16 years as of yesterday. I'd like to thank Chairwoman Stutz, the members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in support of HCR 9. I'd like to emphasize this is not an environmental issue. This is one of protecting Alaska jobs and resources from a cross-border threat. In contrast to other resource issues in Southeast Alaska, this has united people across the region. It hasn't divided them. What I'd like to do today is look at the transboundary issue through the lens of the Tulsa Chief. Alaska fishermen leaders began raising water quality and fisheries concerns related to this mine nearly 20 years ago, calling for federal intervention through the Boundary Waters Treaty and the Associated International Joint Commission. Short history of the mine: abandoned in 1957 without any reclamation. Since then, two companies have gone bankrupt trying to reopen the mine. Repeated inspections by BC and Canada have found acid mine drainage into salmon habitat in violation of mine permits, water quality standards, and the Canadian Federal Fisheries Act. Yet little was done to stop the pollution. BC has repeatedly said its mine permitting process would halt the pollution. It did not. Now, instead of enforcing the law and being a responsible upstream neighbor, BC is still counting on some unnamed new company to buy the mine and be responsible for cleanup, and now they are claiming the situation is not a, quote, emergency, unquote, and it may not need to be cleaned up. So we have an ongoing discharge of toxic acid mine drainage into salmon habitat and no clear commitment to clean it up. Reopening the mine is not a cleanup plan. It's a recipe for another bankruptcy and more delay. We were initially encouraged by Minister Bennett's reaction to his visit to the Tulsa Chief in August when he promised to clean up the acid mine drainage. However, since then, he's backtracked on that commitment. He has downplayed the pollution. He's claimed that there was no contamination in the river, despite obvious and direct evidence to the contrary. He's admitted the discharge exceeds water quality standards, but said the situation was not an emergency. If BC isn't going to enforce their water quality standards, then what good are they? Is that new standard, no action is going to be taken unless there's an emergency? Is it then too late? If BC Cantor won't solve the pollution problem at this relatively small mine, what can we expect at much larger mines like KSM in the Unic and Red Chris in the Stikeen? Several implications of the Tulsa Chief for the larger transboundary region. Clearly, BC has insufficient bonding for its mines. The polluter pay principle does not work when a company goes bankrupt and a bond is inadequate. We have weak enforcement of laws designed to control pollution and protect salmon habitat. As President Reagan told the used with the Russians, trust but verify. We need more than just a handshake agreement. We need binding and enforceable protections. The SOC, the Statement of Cooperation Process, is doing little to pressure BC into cleaning out this mine. The SOC provides no meaningful recourse for us to seek either compensation if there's damage here or to actually get BC to enforce the law. And this is an example of what to expect if our approach to BC is solely focused on using the Statement of Cooperation. In closing, I'd like to say we in Alaska are responsible for protecting our own interests. Instead of hoping BC will do the right thing, we actually need enforceable policies, binding commitments. A coordinated state-federal approach utilizing the Boundary Waters Treaty is reasonable, has the support of thousands of Alaskans, and will better respond to concerns than an approach based solely on the SOC. Why would we not use the strongest tool in the toolbox to protect our resources and jobs? Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions now or in the future.
Thank you. Does the committee have any questions for Mr. Zimmer? Seeing none, we thank you, Mr. Zimmer, for your testimony.
Someone's phone just made a noise.
Next, we'll move to Fred Olson. Mr. Olson?
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. And I do apologize in advance. It's not my intention to offend anyone or insult anyone. And I appreciate the committee's work on this issue. And thank you very much. You obviously listened to the testimony at the hearing back in October.
Mr. Olson, before you go any further, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, we would appreciate it.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Yes, my name is Frederick Otilius Olson, Jr. I'm the Tribal Vice President of the Organized Group of Kasan, and I'm the Chairman of the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group.
Thank you. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate this opportunity and appreciate Representative Ortiz and Chris Tompkins and the other sponsors of the joint resolution. And as you can tell, I speak in support of HJR 9, and you have probably received already the Organized Village of Kasan's Tribal Council has approved a resolution supporting HJR 9. And just on the face of it, as you've already heard from the representative and Mr. Zimmer, just on the industry alone, this makes sense. But when you consider our way of life, this is a no-brainer. And our way of life cannot merely be a cost of doing business. And thank you for recognizing that an international issue needs international solutions. And thanks again. There were some updates to the language, and Ms. Hanfa mentioned that you added the Bruce Jack, and I thank you for that, because that's also a very important project that is possibly influenced the Unic River watershed. And that's what quite a bit of a point. There's a lot to talk about. I have very little time, of course. I appreciate that. But I wonder if there is opportunities for language. One, for sure, at the very end, you know, you can see the resolution is simply strongly urging the federal government to get involved. But I would ask that on behalf of the state of Alaska's tribal citizens, that the legislature call on the United States to uphold its fiduciary trust responsibility to federally recognized tribes with an International Joint Commission review of our area called for in the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909. And there are some, you know, whereas clauses in HJR 9 that they, you mentioned the Boundary Waters Treaty, and then you mentioned some other aspects, but if I may suggest that in the one whereas on the second page, it mentions Tulsa Chief, you could add that this could trigger the Boundary Waters Treaty under Article 4. Article 4 addresses harm and prevents the harm that one side, one party would do to the other, you know, the country, U.S. or Canada. And, of course, Tulsa Chief is an example, polluting at this moment that we're talking. And then also, thank you for including the Brucejack. And then I would go further that, again, this the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909. And Article 9 mentions from time to time these areas can be looked at by the International Joint Commission, and you can look it up. It's never been used in Alaska, which has more boundary with Canada than, of course, any state in the Union, and maybe all of them combined, I don't know. But anyway, it's never been used here, and again, it's from 1909, so you would think from time to time has happened, especially when we're thinking, when we're having consider these lakes of poison that are being created on the other side of the border that we have to monitor forever. And so we're asked to monitor and worry about this stuff forever, but yet the federal government has never looked at our area. And so I suspect to be a potential to maybe slightly, if I may say, make the resolution slightly stronger. But as it is, It does a lot of the things that we've asked for, both the tribe, the Organized Village of the Sand, and the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group have sought for years federal involvement in this issue, because, of course, the United States government has a government-to-government relationship with its federally recognized tribes, and we could talk about this all day long, but I appreciate very much this opportunity to speak by phone. It shows that in Alaska we can do things, and it shows, and thank you for, you know, not having our organization have to spend a lot of travel money to contribute to this effort. Paula, thank you very much, and I could take a question if you had any.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from this committee for Mr. Olson? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I wanted to thank Fred for his advocacy on this, among many other issues.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Olson. We appreciate your testimony. Next, we'll have Dr. Dave Chambers. Dr. Chambers?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is David Chambers. I'm with a small nonprofit organization called the Center for Science and Public Participation out of Bozeman, Montana. And this organization is a technically oriented organization focusing on primarily on the environmental impacts of mining. I'm a geophysicist by training, and my research interests are in tailings dam failures, and I did present before this committee in October on that. I also do some research on financial sureties for both mine closure and post-closure, and I'm also looking at water quality impacts from mining exploration. I do support this resolution. And I thought it might be in the committee's interest today to look at what BC has done in the way of regulatory changes to its reclamation policy since the Mount Pawley mind failure in 2014. Mm-hmm. I've sort of categorized those into two things, looking at financial surety, and then I also want to talk about the code changes. The code is essentially the regulations in British Columbia. If we can go to the second slide, please. So, first of all, a few facts. BC has a total unfunded reclamation liability of $1.2 billion. This means that their closure reclamation, that's not post-closure, this is just closure for mines that are there, they give a discount, and they call it that, a discount to mines for their reclamation surety. So, for instance, if they cost it out that it would take $100 million to reclaim a mine, they might say, well, mining company A, we think you're a good guy and you're good for your word, so we'll only make you put $50 million of that down. And now this does place the state of Alaska at some risk, because if there were to be a failure at one of these mines and they didn't have enough reclamation monies to close it, then the government of BC would either have to come up with those monies or allow the environmental impacts to continue. This doesn't speak to compensating businesses or individuals or organizations or companies that might be hurt from a mine failure or closure situation. Now, BC has said that it intends to reduce this liability over the next 8 years, but it's not going to eliminate it. And I just want to talk a minute about what they call their risk-based approach. Risk-based essentially means that, again, a company doesn't have to have the total amount of surety that's calculated for closure. So they are able to give what's called a corporate guarantee, which is a piece of paper from the corporation saying we promise to close this mine properly, even though we don't have all the money in trust to do that. I'd also like to point out that there is no financial surety for a catastrophic mine accident like Mount Polley. The reclamation sureties that BC holds, either through actual monies or through promises, doesn't address a catastrophic failure. And one of the things the Mount Polley panel predicted was that BC is going to see two mine failures every 10 years in the future if they don't significantly change their policy. Let's go to the next slide, please. So BC, again, uses this risk-based approach. I've outlined a number of reasons there why risk-based approaches, corporate letters / corporate guarantees aren't appropriate. I hope you'll have the time to review this slide in more detail later. If you could click once again so that the bottom two are highlighted in yellow. I just want to talk about those for a moment. BC has said that it needs to have these corporate guarantees to stay competitive. But what it does is creates a competitive advantage for mining companies that operate mines in British Columbia. Alaska, for instance, requires 100% guarantee. And if a mine in Canada that's competing with an Alaska mine only has to pay 50%, that gives it a competitive advantage. So I don't agree with BC's rationale. I don't think they need to do that to stay competitive. They're trying to create a competitive advantage. And I did look at this in more detail. I can't call it exhaustive research, but in looking at it, what I found was that Canadian provinces and Australian states are primarily the ones who are using corporate guarantees or a risk-based approach to establish the amount of financial surety. If we can go to the next slide, please. So again, this isn't exhaustive research. If you can click again so that the yellow highlights come up. So what I found was that, for instance, in Canada, four of the 10 provinces and territories already require 100% guarantee. British Columbia is not among them, obviously. In Australia, there's seven states, two of which already require 100% guarantees. And in the U.S., at a federal level, BLM, Forest Service, requires 100%. Most states require 100%. And interestingly enough, Alaska and Nevada are the two states, the only states that I know of that allow corporate guarantees. In Alaska, the state has chosen not to implement that provision, so at present they don't allow that, so it's legally available to them. And in Nevada, they still have some $140 million corporate guarantees outstanding. That amount has gone down every year since about 2003. So Nevada is essentially phasing out corporate guarantees again, even though it's legal for them to use those. So this corporate guarantee process is something that's on its way out because it poses too much risk to the public. Next slide, please. I want to mention a couple of other things, areas where I think BC policy is weak or failing. The poly expert panel said that safety attributes should be evaluated separately from economic considerations, and cost should not be the determining factor. If you can click again so that the yellow highlights come up. The way the system works now, cost is the determining factor, for instance, in designing a tailings dam. If safety were the issue, we would have downstream-type dams only. But in BC, they primarily use centerline dams, which are cheaper. They're almost as safe, but they're not as safe as downstream dams. And then occasionally, even in the U.S. and Canada, we see upstream-type construction, which is the cheapest construction. It's the type of construction that failed at the Samarco Dam in Brazil last year. And that's the cheapest and most unsafe. So if you look at the changes that BC made to the Reclamation Code, this issue of safety versus cost is not addressed. If you look at the code guidance document, which is the guidance for implementing the code, the only place that they talk about safety is in the risk assessment part of that guidance document. And there they say it must be considered as an element of consideration, but it's on the same level with financial impacts. So again, BC has not stressed that safety must be the primary consideration in design of its tailings dams. Next slide, please. The other important thing was the panel said that has not been implemented in BC is that the panel says surface water should be eliminated from an impoundment. If you could click again so that the highlights come up. In the code itself, there's no requirement for minimizing the amount of water in the tailings on closure. The guidance document talks about it in a little more detail. They say there should be an effort to reduce and remove water, and that alternatives to water covers should be considered. But again, they don't emphasize the fact that dry closures are the goal. A dry closure is much more stable than a wet closure. If you have a wet closure, then you have the possibility of a failure like a Mount Polly type failure. And I'd also like to point out that all of the sulfide mines that are either operating or proposed in the transboundary region utilize wet closures. Next slide, please. So here's a summary of what's sort of happened in the last here. Code was published as a draft in July of last year. That's 2 years post Mount Polly. I personally submitted 19 pages of comments. The final code that was February of this year, there were no changes to the codes. There were no changes, there were no response to comments like we're accustomed to seeing here in the U.S. So I don't know if the state of Alaska made some suggested changes to B.C., but if they did, then B.C. didn't respond to them either. Because, again, there's no change, essentially no change from the draft to the final. I'd also like to point out that on the same day that they published the code, they also issued a final operating permit for the Red Chris mine. The Red Chris mine is a mine with the exact same dam design that failed at Mount Polly. It's a mine that's run by the same company that runs Mount Polly Mine. The province required a $12 million financial surety. I estimate that that's probably three to four times low for what it would really cost to close that mine. So even if we say it's only half, the province, again, is giving a discount to the operating company of the Red Chris mine, the same company that had a dam fail, yet they're saying it's worth the risk to the public to give these folks a discount, and that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. There's also the ASM mine that's proposed. It's permitted. The construction hasn't commenced. The EIS for that mine predicts that copper and lead could exceed Alaska water quality standards at the border on the Yunek River as it goes into Misty Fjords National Monument. So basically what they're saying is that the whole Yunek River between the mine and the Alaska border is going to be a mixing zone for copper and lead. And that's just something that I've never seen before, quite frankly. That mine would also require post-closure treatment of 171 million gallons a day. And just for a rough idea of how much that is, that means enough water to fill the Berkeley pit here in Montana every 2 weeks. I took the cost figures and the volume figures from that EIS, and my estimate is that they're going to have a reclamation, a post-closure surety, just to operate the treatment plant of $1.2 billion. That is, you need to put that much money in the bank to generate enough money to run all those treatment plants. And that would be, that $1.2 billion is about the amount that BC has for all of the other mines in the province right now. Next page. So finally, one more quote from the Mount Polly panel. The panel rejects any notion that business as usual can continue. And I would argue that continuing corporate guarantees, continuing to allow dam designs that put cost as an equal or, as is presently the case in most places, a primary consideration over safety, and to allow impoundments to be closed as wet closure so that if there were a failure, that material would escape very easily. That's business as usual. And I've got to think that's what they're doing there. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to field them.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Chambers. Are there any questions for Dr. Chambers? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chambers, just, you know, when we're talking about the $1.2 billion unfunded reclamation costs for the Mount Polly disaster, and it said that they're going to be, you know, over the next 8 years working, I guess, to pay that down, but I'm just trying to understand, you know, what kind of environmental damage occurs over an eight-year period by not addressing the problem quickly.
Okay, so that at $1.2 billion, that's the gap between the amount that's calculated for reclamation closure. Again, this is just plant closure for all of the mines in BC, and the amount of money they actually have in the bank to cover it. So that's not Mount Polly, that's all the mines in BC. And it means there's a gap. And the money they have can't be used. In other words, that whole sum they have isn't available for a failure at a mine. The only monies that are available for a failure at Mine X are the monies that are specifically held for that mine. So, for instance, in my Red Chris example, if that mine were to go bankrupt and the province would have to close it, I'm saying they have to find another $12 to $48 million somewhere, because they only have 12, and that's not enough to close it.
Thank you.
Alaska, on the other hand, requires all the money needed for closure to be paid. And Red Dog Mine has a closure surety of well over $500 million right now. And that's equal probably to Teck's entire reclamation surety for half a dozen mines in British Columbia.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Chambers, for your testimony.
Thank you very much for allowing it.
Next we have Lindsay Bloom.
Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah, well, I'll ask. We'll hold it over.
Three. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Bloom, and I'm here today with United Fishermen of Alaska. Let's see, I don't know that I have a whole lot to say besides what's been said, and you'll find our written testimony over the years in your packets as well. United Fishermen of Alaska is a statewide commercial fish and trade organization. We are composed of 35 commercial fishing groups representing fishermen who participate in both state and federal fisheries. Many of those groups are from Southeast Alaska and have direct concerns about the issue at hand today. They include trollers, gill netters, seiners, and non-salmon fishermen, all of whom are pretty highly concerned about the threats from the impacts of large-scale mineral development upstream from Alaskan rivers, salmon rivers. The resolution urges the United States federal government to investigate long-term, region-wide downstream effects of proposed and existing industrial development in Bristol Bay and in transboundary water, in BC and transboundary watersheds, as well as, and I think this is the most important part, to develop with the Canadian federal government a binding agreement that ensures enforceable measures and financial assurances that would protect the livelihoods of Alaskans and commercial fishermen here. And we remain convinced that a binding agreement between the United States and Canada is the only way to ensure that Alaska's interests are protected. Impacts to water quality, which is an all-too-common side effect of large-scale hard rock mining projects, could hurt fisheries and fishing jobs in Alaska. Canadians and mining companies are receiving all of the economic benefits from the projects, and we are holding all the liability for the risk. Particularly fishermen are left to carry this. Commercial fishing in Southeast Alaska, which I think you'll hear more about in a little bit, is worth $1 billion per year on average. In conclusion, I want to just acknowledge your responsiveness, Representative Stutes, this committee, Representative Ortiz, et cetera, and other members of the legislature. Also, the Alaska delegation in D.C., Senator Murkowski in particular, has brought this issue before the State Department and most recently with Canada's Prime Minister Trudeau. Passage of this resolution shows the kind of leadership that I think Alaskans are looking for from our representatives at both the state and federal level, and I would encourage the committee to just move the resolution today so that we have a chance of actually getting it through the body sometime soon. I think that time is of the essence on this. As you've been hearing, the projects are in operation and well underway on development, and I think we need to reach a conclusion on this issue very soon, so I hope you'll pass it today.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know the locations of all these mines that are mentioned in them, but, for example, because of the way the affluent, you know, would travel through the waterways and then out into the ocean, essentially, I mean, are there other salmon, beyond salmon, are there other species that we should be concerned about in terms of impacts once, you know, the tailings would travel that far?
Right. So through the chair, Representative Tarr, I am not a fisheries biologist or scientist, so you might want more technical expertise on that question. What I do know is commercial fishermen who target other species in Alaska do have concern. And what I do know, just as a lifelong Alaskan and Southeast Alaskan commercial fisherman, is that water quality in estuary zones for species like crab and bottom fish and non-salmon species is critically important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Ms. Bloom. Next we have Kristen Shelton-Walker.
I'm Kirsten Shelton-Walker with McDowell Group. We're an economic consulting firm in Juneau and Anchorage. And Salmon State contracted with us to take a look at the economic impacts of three watersheds in that flow between BC and Alaska. So we looked at the Taku River, the Stikine River, the Unik River, and they also asked us to do a preliminary analysis of the Nass and Skeena rivers. And those rivers don't flow into Alaska, but fish from those rivers does. Thank you. Fish from those rivers does do come down, and our fishermen fish for them. Oops, wrong one. So when we look at the economic impacts of a river, of a watershed. Okay. we look at quite a few factors. We look at the jobs and labor income that are created from businesses that do business in the watershed. We look at watershed-related businesses that operate in communities outside of the watershed, and we look at the spending of those employees in communities throughout Southeast and Alaska. We also look at visitor spending, tax benefits from properties that are located in the watersheds, and we look at, I'll talk about this in a bit, but the present value of future benefits for, because of these rivers are renewable resources, and so there's some perpetual benefits if they're managed appropriately. And here's a little more of a look at the river economics. You have if you have healthy ecosystems in Southeast Alaska, they'll generate jobs from commercial fishing, from visitor industry, from recreation activity, because people buy things when they go out to recreate, hunting, trapping, same thing. There's also a lot of intangible benefits, as you can imagine, from personal use and recreation activity. So we measured what we could in the study. And in the interest of time, I won't go through every single number in our study here, but I will show you kind of the broad brush. So for the Taku River watershed, we took into account all economic activity, including direct spending and spending that was induced. We have about $33 million in spending annually in the Taku River watershed. Labor income of about $13 million and average annual employment of about 260 million jobs. And when you look at the 30-year present value, so the value if this watershed is maintained and the activity is maintained out 30 years, that's $650 million in present value. And we did the same thing for the Stikine, and once again, I can pause here for a minute. We can go back if you want, but we looked at the commercial fisheries, sport fishing, visitor industry, tax revenues. We also looked at hunting revenue and personal use revenue, and came up with about $13 million in spending annually, labor income of about $6 million, and 117 jobs annually. And that made for $250 million in present value. Unik was the same. It's a bit smaller because it's more isolated, but we also looked at that river and were able to estimate about $2.5 million in spending annually, labor income of about 1.2, average annual employment of 24, and 30-year present value of $50 million. when you look at it a little bit differently and combine the rivers, you can look at the seafood industry on its own, which, as Lindsay Bloom said, it's a significant source of jobs, income, and spending in the region. Sport fishing, visitor industry are also very significant, and then there's some other spending. So you have about $48 million in economic impact every year on Alaska. And I should stress, we didn't look at the economic impact on Canada. This is all just activity within the state. And so if you look out 50 years, because if you, as we said, if you manage these resources appropriately, they are renewable resources, and these benefits can continue in perpetuity. If you look at 50 years and you value what that value would be presently, it's $1.2 billion. So these are valuable watersheds to the state. I can entertain questions if you like. We have an awful lot of numbers.
Thank you, and I'd like to recognize Representative Eastman has joined us. Are there questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sheldon Walker, you mentioned about the economic values of fisheries and tourism and such. Did you look at the economic value of the support industry for mining in Southeast Alaska? I know that there's quite a few folks from the Juneau area here make livings off of those. What about the mining industry and economic values of that?
We did not, because I... At least maybe the next speaker could talk a bit more about this, but when we were looking at it, there weren't any active mining activity going between Southeast and BC. We didn't look at the mining in, we've looked at it in other studies, but not the mining in Southeast in this study.
Follow Thank up? You, Madam Chair.
Oh. Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you were looking for the ex vessel value, for example, for seafood, what species were you looking at?
Well, we looked at any species that we thought might come from the river. We stopped at the mouth of each river, so we looked at just the five salmon species.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And next we have Heather Hardcastle.
Great. Thank you. I'm Heather Hardcastle, and I'm with Salmon Beyond Borders, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Salmon Beyond Borders. And I'm wondering, just first of all, Madam Chair, if I could have your permission to share this map with the committee, especially with Representative Tarr. And it's a map of the Taku, the Stikine, and the Yunik watersheds as they overlap the border.
Certainly. If you hand it to my committee aide.
Okay.
Did you want to see this particular?
Yeah, I would love that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak. I will try to keep my remarks brief, as you've heard a lot of information, and I'm certainly happy to take questions at the end. I want to be clear, of course, that Salmon Beyond Borders wholeheartedly supports HJR 9. We are a campaign driven by thousands of sport and commercial fishermen, community leaders, tourism and recreation business owners, and concerned citizens. And for the last 3.5 years, we have worked toward an international solution to this brewing international situation in the Taku, the Stikine, and the Yunik watersheds that Alaska shares with BC. The four main points I want to stress today, and just briefly, are the following. Number one, if you are to support HJR 9 today, you are standing with literally tens of thousands of Alaskans who are asking for an international mechanism to address and to protect their way of life and our resources in Alaska. You're also, number two, going to be standing with the congressional delegation, as has been mentioned. Senators Murkowski and Sullivan, as well as Congressman Young, have been real passionate advocates for some sort of an international solution to this brewing problem. We were just in Washington, D.C. recently with Alaskans, and they're only more committed, I would say now, under a new administration, to try to encourage the State Department to really work closely with Canada to come up with some protections for our U.S. and Alaska interests. They also underscored how important legislative resolutions like HJR 9 truly are in getting them to have colleagues support them and also in putting additional pressure on the State Department and Secretary of Interior and on the EPA, those primary agencies that work closely with Canadian counterparts. Thirdly, I wanted to mention that when I was in Washington, D.C. with Alaskans, I was also traveling with Montanans. And collectively, as a group, we met with the Alaska Congressional Delegation, with the Montana Congressional Delegation, and with federal agencies. And the Montanans have a compelling story to share, and it landed with a thud for our Congressional Delegation and for the State Department alike. You see, Montana shares rivers with British Columbia as well, and for a lot longer than Alaska has been working with British Columbia to try to ensure that downstream interests are protected from upstream British Columbia coal mining. In the Flathead watershed that Montana shares with British Columbia, the International Joint Commission was involved in the 1980s, and that is a watershed that is still intact and not polluted. However, the neighboring watershed, the Elk Kootenai watershed, is severely impaired, and that is a watershed that Montanans, their tribes in Montana, as well as the Montana Congressional Delegation, has been working for years to get the federal government to push with Canada for those protections. That has been to no avail. And so there's just been a state-provincial memorandum of understanding in place there. But today they have fish kills and deformed fish upstream in British Columbia in the Elk River, and the water of the Kootenai River at the border with Montana does not meet Montana water quality standards for selenium. So they are now facing an impaired watershed forever. And then finally, in closing, I want to touch on the remarks of Robin Allen. And she is an independent economist based in Vancouver. She's also a renowned expert on risk. She was a former president and chair of the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia. Certainly someone not prone to hyperbole. She prepared a report that's in your packet. A summary is in your packet. And she's out of the country today. And so she asked that I share a portion of her report. So, and I quote, this is from Robin Allen. "The environmental assessment, monitoring, and compliance of British Columbia's mining sector is dysfunctional. It places the environment and the public on both sides of the Canadian and U.S. border at serious long-term risk. Assurances from the government of BC that the risks are being addressed effectively are without substance. The laudable goals of the Alaska-British Columbia Statement of Cooperation simply cannot be achieved under British Columbia's current regulatory regime. The province of British Columbia refuses to assume responsibility to adequately protect downstream interests. And in fact, they really can't. Therefore, HJR 9 requesting that the Canadian and U.S. governments develop measures to ensure downstream resources are not harmed is timely and necessary," unquote. So I thank you today for voting yes on HJR 9 to move it out of this body, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You'd stated, again, it was a statement by the economist from British Columbia, that basically that the Canadian DEC is inadequate and unable to manage their job, doing their job in protecting the waters, based on what information? You gave a couple examples, but I don't know if that was from natural occurring contaminants or what's going on.
Sure. Yeah, there's been a number of documents in the last few years that have come out speaking to this and to the deficiencies in the mining sector in terms of compliance and enforcement. A big one, Representative Newman, and excuse me, I forgot to say through the chair to Representative Newman, a very compelling report is one by the British Columbia Auditor General from May 2016, and that is on BASIS, so you can look at that report, but it's scathing. I don't have a direct quote, but basically it's along the lines of when the Auditor General looked at every measure, every metric of success and productivity in terms of mining compliance and enforcement, they have a failing grade.
Follow-up?
No, I would just be interested to see what our Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has to say about the tributaries that are coming through Alaska and water quality, how they manage, how they work with the federal government in Canada, you know, to look at these. And I'm concerned to know where we're at with our Alaska DEC. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. And we've requested that they call in. So as soon as they do, we'll put them on. Thank you kindly for your testimony. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that concludes our invited testimony, but I will now open up public testimony. And I have Mike Satri. Thank you. If you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Stutes and members of the House Special Committee on Fisheries. My name is Mike Satri. I was born and raised here in Southeast Alaska, and Juneau is my home. I'm the manager of government and community relations at the Hecla Greens Creek Mine. I'm the president of the Council of Alaska Producers and vice president of the Alaska Miners Association. I have been a member of Lieutenant Governor Malott's ad hoc citizens working group on transboundary issues representing the Alaska Miners Association, and I'm here on the behalf of AMA today. Industrial development in the transboundary is not experiencing unprecedented or rapid expansion. However, we do support the rights of Alaskans to raise concerns regarding upstream development, especially when upstream is located in another country. Unfortunately, this resolution disregards the significant efforts made by the Walker-Mulott administration to foster collaboration and encourage responsible development balanced with water and habitat protections. The mining industry has fully supported these efforts as they are the only realistic manner by which Alaskan regulatory agencies can have meaningful engagement in the permitting process of a foreign country. British Columbia and Montana have successfully managed transboundary issues in the Flathead River Basin, as you've already heard, through a memorandum of understanding, not through the IJC, that was established in 2010, and there's no reason we can't have the same success. We would encourage the committee to add language to this resolution that supports the MOU and SOC that are currently in place. By not supporting our administration in their efforts, the legislature would be sending a clear message to British Columbia that we do not want to engage with them. We'd also like to address the fallacy in asking for federal engagement on this issue. As a bit of an aside, it seems like there's hardly a day that goes by here in the Capitol that there isn't a resolution or floor speech that complains bitterly of federal overreach and lauds the ability of Alaskans to solve our own problems. But suddenly, when it comes to this issue, that's not the case. Not only is federal intervention not needed here, but quite frankly, the legislature should realize the futility of invoking the Boundary Waters Treaty and the International Joint Commission. The Boundary Waters Treaty specifically excludes from its authority those waters that cross borders. The treaty is meant for waters that lay along or parallel to borders such as the Great Lakes. However, in Article 4 of the treaty, there is a caveat that neither country shall pollute waters flowing into the other. So there's already a legal mechanism in place for an aggrieved party on either side of the border to seek compensation should a problem occur. I think you've heard in prior invited testimony that that may be a way to deal with the Tolsequaw Chief. So, all that being said, even if the Boundary Waters Treaty is invoked and an IJC reference from both countries proceeds, because that is possible, it will take years, even decades, for any recommendation to be made. And the recommendation is just that, a non-binding recommendation that would still require approval and implementation by both countries. So, by involving the federal government, Alaska would potentially have to wait for decades for a non-binding result, instead of utilizing a state-to-province agreement that's already in place. This makes no sense. This is why we have to support the Lieutenant Governor in the process outlining the MOU and SOC and invite our federal agencies to participate with us. So, it's important that the legislature make its opinion known on issues like transboundary development. It's important, very important, that legacy problems like Tulsa Chief are dealt with immediately. However, the new version of HJR 9 has multiple problems and needs significant amendments before it moves forward. We have prepared some detailed amendments, and as this resolution works through the process, I see we have a hearing in another committee already scheduled. We'll work to with the sponsor and committee members to submit those amendments in the hopes that we can all support this resolution moving forward. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Are there questions from this committee? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For clarity, you mentioned there's already a mechanism for aggrieved parties to seek relief effectively, and I think that statement was in reference to the IJC. I missed what that specific mechanism was. Could you clarify?
So I'm in no legal expert. However, I have read the Boundary Waters Treaty, and in Article 4, it states that waters that flow across a border shall not be polluted. So there is a legal treaty mechanism for aggrieved parties to seek relief. Now, how exactly you do that, I don't think we go down to our local courtroom and file a suit, but I'm sure there's a mechanism. We have a treaty in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. State Chair, I appreciate your comments, but I guess I just disagree with them very strongly. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, we have a $3 billion deficit. Our state departments are barely operational at this point, and DEC is like bare bones. I can't see how we would possibly have the resources to appropriately deal with this. I mean, absolutely, I hope the state of Alaska has a seat at the table, but our congressional delegation is very much in support of this measure. And, you know, I think this is just one of those circumstances where we need to, you know, we need to invite everybody. We need to look for every resource possible. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, why you think the congressional delegation would support this measure. They're typically pretty pro-development individuals, but they're asking to be involved in that, and why you kind of disagree with that position.
Thank you, Representative Tarr, through the chair. I think we disagree on the way that our congressional delegation wants involvement in this area. The state of Alaska has incredible resource agencies. Yes, we've been cutting to them the bone, or it's something that's reflective of our current fiscal situation, but there's excellent people in those departments. There are recent reimbursable service agreements that have already been used by Canadian companies to involve our agencies in those permitting discussions, and so we certainly can work with British Columbia to have the time and efforts of our agencies as they're involved in the technical working group prescribed by the Statement of Cooperation. We can look to have companies sponsor that involvement. I think it's what we do with our resource companies here in Alaska. We have already done that with companies in BC, and we should continue to do that. We are in no way saying that we shouldn't be involved. We should be involved here. But we have a process in place. Let's take the lead. Let's set the example. Let's work with British Columbia to foster responsible development.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. It's good to see the folks for local miners here. Do you, McDowell presented the committee with a report on economics. It looked at fishing and tourism and such. Does the mining industry in Alaska, the support industries that work for the mining industries and the Alaskans that work within the mining industry, is there an economic impact to Alaskans and Alaska companies with Canadian mining companies? Is there an interplay between the two, and how does that work if there is?
Thank you, Representative Newman, through the chair. There is a great mining support industry here in Southeast Alaska, but we also have two producing mines here in the Juneau area. The ability for that industry, for the people of Southeast Alaska to be employed in the British Columbia mines, to be able to take goods and services across the border, not an area that I'm an expert in, but I think that's probably a great area to ask for help from our congressional delegation to find out how we can open up the trade pathways so that we can utilize our existing experience and support development there, because ultimately that's one of the issues. People see all the benefit being on the British Columbia side and not on our side, but perhaps we can benefit from responsible development.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My colleague from Anchorage raised the point of financial costs and other restraints on state agencies. Can you contrast what the costs and time and other resources would be between the approach pursued here in this bill versus the approach that you would recommend instead, and also maybe comment on whether both approaches could be pursued simultaneously?
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Through the chair, I think that's a great question to pose to DNR and DEC and the Office of Project Management and Permitting, because I think they have a great handle on the costs of involvement under the MOU and SOC, and certainly can look back to their involvement in some of the prior permitting pathways that they've worked on. So I would unfortunately defer that question to them.
Thank you. And are there other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
And we do have the director of the Division of Water from DEC online, Representative Newman, Michelle Hale. Michelle? Ms. Hale?
Yes, can you hear me now?
We certainly can. Thank you. And thank you for calling in. And we have a question for you from Representative Newman.
Yes, and I apologize, I have joined a little bit late.
That's all right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to hear from the DNR folks, and maybe we can hear from DEC too. But
this is DEC.
Well, this is DEC. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ms. Hale, is there concerns, or does the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, do they have the ability to monitor the waters in southeast Alaska? And do you have any issues currently with any pollutants in the tributaries coming into Alaska? Two questions.
Representative Newman, through the chair, first, my name is Michelle Hale, and I am the director of the Division of Water at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. We do have the ability, limited ability, to monitor the waters in southeast Alaska. And in fact, we have recently, actually we're commencing this year, this fiscal year, to shift a statewide monitoring program where we choose one small region of the state to monitor, and we're shifting that down to southeast Alaska for a five-year period. And that's a monitoring called our Alaska ACMAP, or Alaska Monitoring and Assessment Program. However, the funding for that is very limited. So what we are doing is we've got a concentrated effort to work with partners, and these partners include tribal monitoring efforts. They include monitoring efforts by other federal agencies, for example, the U.S. Geological Services, EPA, the Forest Service. So we're working through, I had to join the call late, but I think that there has been discussion about the Memorandum of Understanding and the Statement of Cooperation with BC. We're working within the auspices of the Statement of Cooperation. We have a technical work group on monitoring that is working with the state agencies, and we're also, as I said, working with federal and other partners in the state, but also working with our counterparts in BC to make sure that any monitoring that we do actually speaks the same language, for example. Relative to do we have any concerns, I think I'd have to really understand that question from a water body specific perspective, but perhaps I can pause here and make sure I've answered your question sufficiently.
Representative Newman? Sure.
Yes, on the concern issue, it's been stated several times by people who have testified on this bill currently, prior, that there is pollutants that are entering into the tributaries, acid waters and such. Are you aware of any tributaries in Alaska that are being polluted by Alaska or by Canadian mines?
Representative Newman, through the chair, that's a broad question. We control within Alaska, we control pollutants entering streams and rivers and tributaries, for example, through our Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permitting Program. And through that program, we do a very thorough analysis of pollutants that might be entering streams, and then we will actually authorize discharge of pollutants with very specific limits so that water quality criteria are met. Sometimes there's a mixing zone, but typically the water quality criteria are met in a short distance from the point of discharge. So So we authorize pollutants to be discharged into streams, but we don't authorize those streams to become polluted. So the whole point of that permitting program is that we monitor very closely what goes into the streams, and then we monitor what is in the streams. Certainly there are, and I'll speak within Alaska now, there are certainly some polluted water bodies. So, for example, we'll have impaired waters, and sometimes those are, for example, due to non-point source pollution. And there also are water bodies that are polluted from old mines. For example, I think the Red Devil Mine, as I understand it, on the Kuskokwim, there are some pollutants entering that river from an old abandoned mine. In terms of Canadian mines, the one point that I am aware of is that there are pollutants entering from the Tulsiqua Chief mine, and that is into a river that then flows into the Taku River. We have not seen evidence that that is causing pollution in the Taku River, but we have not done considerable monitoring there.
Thank you. Just one more.
You, Representative Newman.
Ms. Hale, do you feel you have a good working relationship with the Canadian government as far as monitoring and oversight on tributaries that flow from Canada into Alaska?
Representative Newman, through the chair, I feel that we have a very good working relationship, and it actually is at multiple levels. So I have staff that are actually heading up the technical work group on monitoring, and they've got excellent working relationships with their technical counterparts in BC. So as they're working on the various agreements that we need to make sure that the data we collect speaks to each other and is available to the public, we've got very good relationships with them. I know that I have had very good conversations with counterparts at my level, as had my commissioner, Commissioner Hartig, and I understand certainly that Lieutenant Governor Malott has also had a very good working relationship and conversation. So I would say at multiple levels that is the case. We have a very open relationship, and we have an ability to talk about concerns.
Thank you.
One more, if I can.
Certainly.
So just one more, Ms. Hale. Do you feel that, the work that you do with the Canadian government, is the work that you do adequate to ensure that we are protecting Alaska's southeast tributaries, the fishing industry, the tourism industry, to make sure that our waters are pristine? So do you feel that we have adequate protection currently?
Representative Newman, through the chair, that's a complicated question to answer. I feel that with the agreements that we have been putting in place, and also with our understanding of the regulatory structure in British Columbia, that we have a framework to assure the adequacy of protection, but it is something that does require that ongoing conversation, and that's what these agreements have actually put in place, is the ability and the agreement to have those ongoing conversations so that if we detect any pollution, that we have a way of addressing that. So I think that the conversations that we have and the work that already goes on with the Department of Natural Resources and my staff in my mining section, coupled with these agreements that have been put in place through the Lieutenant Governor's efforts, those create the framework that we can provide that adequate protection, but it requires ongoing work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hale, you know, you described this as a good working relationship, an open working relationship, but there's nothing about good or open that is binding in any way, and there's nothing the state of Alaska can do to force the British Columbia government to do something. I mean, that would have to be government-to-government relationships, and that would have to come through the feds. Isn't that true?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I'm probably not the best person to answer that because those questions are really probably best answered perhaps by my commissioner or somebody at that level. The agreements that we have, for example, the technical working group on monitoring that I've talked about, that is, you're correct, that is not binding, and I don't think the statement of cooperation are either. But exactly how to have a binding agreement, I can't really address that. I don't have the legal background to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions from this committee? Seeing none, we certainly appreciate your testimony, Ms. Hale, and if you could remain online just in case this committee has other questions for you as we continue along with our public testimony. Next, we will go to Karen Mathias in Anchorage. Ms. Mathias?
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Spitz and the members of the House Special Committee on Fisheries. My name is Karen Mathias, and I'm the Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers, a statewide business association that represents the large metal mines and some advanced projects in Alaska. Among other things, the Council of Alaska Producers promotes economic opportunity and environmentally sound mining practices. I also represent the Council of Alaska Producers on the Lieutenant Governor's Citizens Working Group on transboundary issues. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. Recognizing the need to protect and enhance the shared environment, CAP fully supports collaboration and dialogue between the state of Alaska and the province of British Columbia on development in BC along rivers that flow from Canada into Alaska. This collaboration is the most appropriate means of ensuring that the interests of both jurisdictions and their citizens are understood and protected. For more than 2 years, Lieutenant Governor Malott has shown great leadership in deepening the existing levels of communication and cooperation between the state and the province on this issue. This work has included an unprecedented level of outreach to stakeholder groups. The 2015 MOU and the 2016 Statement of Cooperation that have been mentioned are both the results of this effort and the starting point for greater collaboration between the province and the state. In fact, the technical work has already begun. The technical working group has been tasked with establishing a reliable and adequate process for the collecting and distributing of baseline and project-specific water quality data and actively engaging with all stakeholders in developing this process. I think it's great that DEC was able to answer questions today, but I would encourage you to ask for a full update from DEC, DNR, and DF&G on this important work. Alaska and BC are the jurisdictions responsible for managing natural resources under the laws of the United States and Canada, respectively. As such, the state and province are the appropriate governmental entities to address transboundary natural resource issues. Seeking federal involvement through the Boundary Waters Treaty would be contrary to the primary jurisdiction of Alaska and BC over natural resources and would unnecessarily burden the cooperative relationship formalized in the MOU and the SOC. I urge you not to pass this resolution as currently drafted and instead consider amendments that would further recognize the value of the Statement of Cooperation, the work of the technical groups, and the efforts of the Lieutenant Governor and the State of Alaska to ensure that our state regulators can have meaningful access and input into the regulatory process in British Columbia. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mathias. Are there questions from this committee? Seeing none, Ms. Mathias, if you have your testimony in writing, could you please provide it to the committee chair so we can distribute it to our committee members?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you kindly. Next, we have Deantha Crockett from in Anchorage. Ms. Crockett?
Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Deantha Crockett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. AMA is a professional trade association for Alaska's mineral industry, mines large and small. We're represented in 8 statewide branches, including southeast locations of Hayden, Juneau, and Ketchikan, Prince of Wales. I'll note that AMA has a letter on the record in response to the first version of HJR 9 that points to the collaboration between the state and the province of British Columbia, led by Lieutenant Governor Malott. We point to the MOU and the Statement of Cooperation agreed upon by both the state and the province, and the technical work that has already begun to further this collaboration. At that time, we suggested the resolution reflect those important advancements in addressing any concerns related to transboundary mining. However, when version B was released, it included new language that insists on federal government intervention and the current collaboration being led by the Lieutenant Governor. It is surprising to us that the legislature would be eager to request federal overreach into the proper management of Alaska's natural resources and the regulatory management of those resources. The legislature should support the efforts on behalf of the Lieutenant Governor and support the regulatory mission of our agencies charged with oversight and development of resources rather than encouraging federal intervention and potentially compromising the cooperative relationship formalized in the Alaska-BC agreement. The Lieutenant Governor's efforts to establish a transboundary working group have resulted in significant achievements, such as the state participation on the Mine Review Committee for the Brewstadt Gold Project and the KSM Project. These kind of results demonstrate that the state of Alaska and the province of British Columbia are working effectively to address their common interests in protecting the waters and the fisheries that are vital to the citizens of both jurisdictions. We should ensure we aren't doing anything to compromise the state of Alaska's ongoing collaborative efforts to protect our resources. Asking for federal involvement is not only unnecessary, but it cedes our rightful authority to manage our resources to the federal government. AMA encourages you to vote no on HJR1 and instead focus energies on supporting Lieutenant Governor Malott and collaborating with our neighbors. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today, and I'll provide you my testimony in writing as well, Representative Stute.
Thank you. And I would also respectfully request, if you have your testimony in writing, if you could provide it to the chair so we could distribute it to our committee members. Are there questions for Ms. Crockett? Thank you, Ms. Crockett. I see no questions. And we have Jill Weitz. If you come forward, state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman Stutes. My name is Jill Weitz, and I reside here in Juneau, Alaska. I work for Salmon Beyond Borders. I also want to mention that prior to my work on the transboundary mining issue, I served as a compliance and enforcement officer for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And so with that, I just want to essentially clear some of the record that I heard today very briefly. One thing in particular related to a reference of the Boundary Waters Treaty, it does in fact apply to waters crossing the border and can be used as a preventative tool to establish financial securities for projects such as those we're speaking to today. It does not just apply to mining failures or abandoned mines in particular. And in reference to that, while in Juneau in 2015 with Lieutenant Governor, Minister Bill Bennett suggested that the federal government would need to be involved to secure financial assurances, and he did see that as a place for federal involvement. I also want to highlight the notion that although we do very much support the statement of cooperation between Alaska and British Columbia and the ongoing efforts between the state agencies and provincial agencies working together, it does not establish those binding protections. And within the statement of cooperation in particular, it clearly identifies the notion that neither the state or the province will put any funding towards these efforts to establish baseline data or securement for long-term monitoring. And additionally, we have met with those on the technical working group, representatives particularly from the Department of Environmental Conservation, that suggest that in a timely manner, though these efforts are ongoing, it will take this five-year project that Michelle Hale referenced to South being Southeast Pacific. Their first year will monitor different lake systems that are not within this in these transboundary watersheds, and it won't essentially create any effort towards the transboundary systems themselves for at least that five-year period. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Ms. Weitz, for your testimony on the Boundary Waters Treaty. I feel fairly familiar with IJC and the process that exists and how it can be invoked, and that it is hard to invoke, but you know the process to go in that direction. I'm very unfamiliar with the Boundary Waters Treaty, which is why I asked a previous testifier about it. What are the next steps to bring that into play with these particular issues? I mean, maybe being specific to the Tulsiquot Chief Mine, which is presently polluting the Taku. What can the state of Alaska do, or what does the federal government need to do to take action?
Sure, thank you. Through the chair and to Representative Christ-Tompkins. The Boundary Waters Treaty, in law, it's written that only one country needs to bring an issue to the table for an International Joint Commission reference. In practice, that's only been successful when both countries come to the table and agree that an issue needs to be reviewed. At this point in time, the efforts that our delegation has championed in Washington, D.C. to continue to try to elevate this issue in the State Department, they're committed to continuing to put pressure on this the State Department, and they are working very closely with their counterparts in Canada, namely the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that would be their counterpart in referring this issue. As far as the state of Alaska's role in activation of the Boundary Waters Treaty, this resolution is a prime example of the support that the delegation can use to continue to fuel that fire and elevate this issue at the State Department and international level. So we, again, fully support it.
Follow up?
Thank you. I think I was conflating Boundary Waters Treaty with that being the authorizing legislation for the IJC.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. That
Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? Please come forward, state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Melanie Brown. I'm affiliated with the Salmon Beyond Borders campaign. I'm an organizer. My work focuses on sharing information with people on how they can engage and the processes that are available to them. And I also commercial fish in the summer in Bristol Bay. And I'm a tribal member of Naknek Native Village in Bristol Bay. So I didn't plan on testifying today, but I walked in at a time when there was a lot of talk around the MOU and SOC that the state of Alaska has been crafting with British Columbia. And I feel that there are good intentions behind that process that's taking place. But so I already mentioned that my work involves sharing information with people, so it requires me to listen a lot, too, so that I can share the information that should go forward to the citizens of Alaska or people who could be impacted by certain developments. And I heard something yesterday, and if I had planned on testifying today, I would have citations to share with you, and I can always find them and share them with you later. But I heard about the MOU-SOC process that Montanans undertook with British Columbia because of an upstream development on the British Columbia side of the border in the Elk Kootenai system that, you know, it was very well intended, but what was agreed upon did not prevent selenium from flowing downstream into Montana and impacting the watershed and causing malformations in generations of fish that reside in that system. And so it's like it doesn't matter how well intended or how well thought out an MOU-SOC process is, if it's not going to keep pollutants from flowing downstream and impacting watersheds and generations of fish, you know, to come. So that's all I have to say today. I think it's important that that be investigated further. You know, before people put too much stock in the MOU and SOC that has been developed by Alaska and British Columbia, it's not an end-all be-all. I don't mean to dismiss it altogether and the good work that has gone into it, but we need to do everything that we can to ensure that our waters will not be impacted by upstream development on the BC side of the border. Thanks for hearing what I had to say.
Thank you. Are there questions? Seeing none, thank you. We certainly appreciate your testimony. I'm told that the DNR will be...
Just at this question.
Oh, okay. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? Seeing no one, I will close public testimony. Are there any questions from this committee or the sponsor? Representative Newman.
Madam Chair, just been reviewing back again, going through some of the statements that have been provided in the public testimony and additional information for the committee. And it consistently has statements by some of these organizations that say the bilateral U.S. Canadians, basically that they're not working. I would certainly like to hear more from our states, DNR and DEC, about why they're not working, and if they're not working, I have concerns about that. So I don't know where we're at on that, but to me it seems a pretty serious issue. We've got quite a few organizations saying that the statement of cooperation between the state and Canada is not working very well, and a process that is clearly flawed. Their statement I've read a couple of times, and that I'm very concerned, if our state has the ability to manage these or not, or we just, I just have questions about that, Madam Chair.
Representative Newman, you're in luck. We have David Shade, DNR Chief Water Resources Section, online. Mr. Shade?
Yeah, name Shady, S-C-H-A-D-E.
Representative Newman has a question for you, please. If you could identify yourself and your affiliation, please, for the record.
My name is David Shady. I am the Water Resources Section Chief in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water in the Alaska Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Mr. Chang, we have statements in here provided by different organizations. I know that I've got a couple I'm looking at here that talk about the statement of cooperation between the state of Alaska and British Columbia government. They state that it's a process that is clearly flawed in their minds, and that their state officials participate in the mine assessments, but it's not very a complete process. Can you comment on your thoughts on your interactions with the Canadian government and your sense on whether you feel we're protecting our tributaries adequately?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Newman. Off of the cuff, a couple of points that have to be made. At one, transboundary issues legally are handled by the State Department, so technical disputes are elevated to the federal government. That being said, the administration, with the leadership of the Lieutenant Governor, has worked to establish direct relationships with our counterparts across the border to have direct input into these proposed projects. While it may not be the best solution, definitely the administration and the departments have worked towards making sure we are actively engaged in protecting the Alaska issues on our side of the border. In fact, we have a working group that's set up a political, technical staff who work directly with the technical staff across the border in looking at these issues. Our Office of Project Management and Permitting is coordinating these efforts, so that we are actively and proactively involved. For example, the Department of Natural Resources requested a full analysis of the water diversions on the Stikine River because our analysis shows that it could impact an in-stream flow reservation in the Stikine River that we have granted to the Department of Fish and Game. So while there may be some things that could be done to do better, in the last few years we've come a long way towards direct cooperation and coordination with the BC government.
Okay, I think.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Are there other questions from this committee? Seeing none, Mr. Shady, we appreciate your testimony and your calling in on a minute's notice.
You're welcome, Madam Chairman.
Is there anyone else here that I've already closed public testimony? So, are there any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I may, just one quick.
You most certainly can, Representative Ortiz.
The memorandum of understanding and the SOC have this representative's full support. I commend the Walker administration under the leadership of Lieutenant Governor Malott in their efforts in this particular area. The reason why I think this resolution needs to go forward is that in the end, such things as a statement of cooperation and a memorandum of understanding in no way can provide the kind of protections that we all want. We all here are for economic opportunities to be enhanced and protected. And by law, under the U.S. Constitution, it's illegal for the state of Alaska and for the British Columbian government to come up with some sort of treaties that would put those kinds of protections that we need in place. We can't do it. We don't have the authority to do that. So what this resolution calls for is for our U.S. government and for the government of Canada to enter into discussions and negotiations on this issue, because in the end, it's only those bodies that can provide the kind of protections that we're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Representative Eastman.
Through the chair, I understand the questions about the process and wanting to change the process. Can you summarize sort of more specifically, at the end of this bill going through the process and any number of changes being made, if it does pass the legislature, what specifically is being sought, other than a process? Obviously, process change, but process change are made for a particular outcome that we hope to achieve. What is it currently that is taking place that we don't want to take place, or that is not taking place that we do? Can you sort of articulate that in any kind of concrete manner? Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it does make sense. Let me again definitively say there's nothing that we don't want to see to continue to happen. We want to see the continued cooperation called for under the Memorandum of Understanding and the SOC to continue. We want those activities to continue. So we're not asking for there to be any reduction or reverse course in those activities. We want them to continue. But let me see if I can answer your question with an example. The other day, I was talking to a group of people at the Native Issues Forum, and the gentleman asked me a question about what is it under the existing situation that we, the state of Alaska, can do if there were some event that would disrupt, that would that would have a negative impact on the traditional cultural and economic activities that currently are going on with these three rivers. And I had to say, there's nothing we can do. If we have an accident, there's nothing we can do under the current situation. So what this resolution calls for is to put in the steps necessary so that there is something that we can do, so that we can actually put in some protections out there, so that we can actually maybe arrive at some financial safeguards in the event that there would be some accident that none of us here would want to see. So that's hopefully that answers your question.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Seeing none, Representative Chenault?
Madam Chairman, I would ask and move amendment number one.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, in response to the events in Canada and concerns expressed by Alaskans, Lieutenant Governor Malott has established the Transboundary Working Group to provide states involvement activities proposed in BC that could impact Alaska waters and fish. As a result of those meetings, Madam Chairman, the state and the province developed the MOU that we have been talking about most of the morning today in 2015. The Statement of Cooperation on the Transboundary Waters implementing the MOU was signed by Alaska and BC in 2016. Statement of Cooperation, a bilateral working group was formed, and has also formed a technical working group on monitoring and developing a plan for monitoring water quality in the transboundary rivers. These results demonstrate that the state of Alaska and the province of British Columbia are working effectively to address the common interest in the protecting the waters and the fisheries that are vital to the citizens of both jurisdictions. Madam Chairman, I feel that we should be supporting the state and the province by making sure that they have what they need to accomplish the objectives of the MOU and the Statement of Cooperation. And we should also ensure that we are not doing anything to compromise the state of Alaska's ongoing collaborative efforts to protect our resource. And asking for the federal government not only is not necessary, but it secedes Alaska's rightful authority to maintain its resources to the federal government. So, Madam Chairman, one group I haven't heard from, and that is maybe the Lieutenant Governor. Alaskans expressed their concerns over the issues that we have before us, and our Lieutenant Governor and our Governor have signed the MOUs with the Canadian provinces to start this working group to protect Alaska's interests. Madam Chairman, I know that maybe there are things that we can't do as a state that has to be done through the federal government. But my concern is that we are relinquishing our power as a state to the federal government, and it causes me some concern. So, Madam Chairman, that's basically what the amendment does, is it tells us to that we strongly urge the United States government to continue to work with the government of Canada to support the efforts of the state and BC to collaborate on proposed and existing industrial upstream development in British Columbia.
Thank you. Representative Chenault. Comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Representative Chenault bringing this forward, but there's nothing in this resolution that will interfere with the existing agreements and that work going forward. And as we've learned, the only way, you know, to have something and be legally binding in a transboundary situation is through our federal government and through the federal government of Canada. So at this time, I can't support this amendment, but I do, you know, appreciate the recognition that the state is doing work, and I hope that work will continue. But I do think it needs to be elevated to the higher level, because that's the only way we will have something that has permanency, and our salmon are that important, and we have to do it.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Representative Price-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share Representative Tarr's comments. I guess there are two fundamental perspectives. I think first, this resolution or this approach with IJC is additive and supplementary. It's not an either-or question, or if it is, I haven't sort of been convinced of that. And my second perspective is, were a state-to-province relationship working and able to achieve real results, I'd like to think we would have seen some resolution to the Tsilhqot'kw' chief situation on the Taku, which, of course, we haven't, and to this very day, to this very minute, is presently a problem.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support the amendment. I like the thought that Alaska can manage its own, and I believe that I heard from the Departments of Environmental Conservation and Alaska Department of Natural Resources that they felt they had a good working relationship with the Canadian government, and they could work with them to ensure that Alaska's waters maintain being clean, that they can continue to do that, and I think they should be able to work within the working agreement. It was just done last year. And I'd like to see that given a chance. Madam Chair, we have no idea what the federal government can walk into and impose on Alaska on a lot of this. It could be limits on our fisheries or anything. That's why I think it's very important that the state stays engaged in this and certainly support the amendment and their intent to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think that I'm unable to support this because I think it's imperative that we have the ability to have an avenue, if in fact there is an accident, to enforce the responsibility onto the Canadian government, which we don't have now. But more importantly, it sounded to me through the sponsor, and please correct me if I misunderstood you, that our congressional delegation was requesting this in order to help facilitate doing exactly that. So I feel it's very strong, being that it's coming down from our congressional delegation, that we support the original bill on this. And so, unfortunately, I appreciate the sponsors of this amendment's intent, and I understand it totally. But I think it's really important that we move forward. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think there's a contrasting understanding of what the concept of diplomacy is between these two proposals, the amendments and keeping it as is. And I remember hearing in testimony the request that, you know, we go about a process that would, you know, force Canada to do something because the current process wouldn't. And as we look to work at the state or territory level, intergovernment on solutions, you know, certainly we can't force British Columbia to do much. But it's also true when you step back and you go nation to nation, that same problem still exists. You have one country and you have another country, and neither is going to be very able to effectively force the other country to do anything. And certainly if there was a bad actor involved, you know, there's things you can do that are currently available under, you know, certainly lots of areas within diplomacy. Yes, you have these, you know, these mechanisms that, you know, purport to force a country to do this or that. At the end of the day, though, I think you find that, as was stated earlier, even in that kind of venue, if a country decides that they're not going to participate and they're not going to cooperate and they're not going to come to the table, there's very little that can be done to force them to do something. And certainly when you recognize that just as our state budget is being impacted by oil prices, our neighbors in Canada have had similar effects on their budgets as well. When we talk about not having resources available to do all the things that we would like to do with monitoring or enforcement actions, you're likely to find that many of the things that we might wish Canada would do, they're not doing for the same reasons that we're not doing them. I think diplomacy is a very important part of solving these types of situations. And at the end of the day, I conclude that, you know, it's probably the only way to solve them. So I'm supportive of the most, you know, diplomatic solutions possible and maintaining you know, as close a working relationship with both our federal partners and then also those on the other side of the boundary. Regardless of what specific language comes out of this resolution, I would want it to be as clear as possible that we do want to pursue working with our Canadian neighbors as quickly and effectively and collegially as possible. And if you have a specific you know, grievance, then let's follow that grievance process through and let's encourage those in the State Department who are our first, you know, go-to in our current federalistic federal chain, let's push for better working relationships with our federal partners so that they are accurately and effectively representing the interests of Alaskans, which I know is unfortunately not always the case, and we could always do better. Thank you.
Thank you. Further comments? Seeing no further comments, I will maintain my objection. Could we have a roll call vote, please?
Yes, Amendment 1, adoption to HJR 9. Representative Newman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Chenault.
Yes.
Representative Fansler.
No.
Representative Price-Tompkins.
No.
Representative Tarr.
No.
Chair Stutes.
No.
Chair, I have 3 yeas, 4 nays.
Thank you. Having 3 yeas and 4 nays, the motion fails, and so we will move on to the original resolution. Representative Fensler, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that we report HJR 930-LS0303-D from committee with attached fiscal note.
I would object.
Having an objection, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Madam Chair, could you explain
yes.
the vote? Is a yes vote to move the bill, no vote to hold the bill?
That's correct, Representative Newman.
This is for movement of HJR 9 from committee. Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Newman.
No.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Chenault.
No.
Representative Fansler.
Yes.
Representative Price-Tompkins.
Yes.
Chair Stutes.
Yes.
4 yeas, 3 nays, Madam Chair.
With that, with 4 yeas and 3 nays, HJR 9 will move from committee. And seeing no further business to come before this committee, we did well. We will adjourn at 11:55.